How would you like to live in this city? Unfortunately, it's not the city that Cody just read to us about. It is not the city described in Revelation, chapters 21 and 22. This other city is the one described in Revelation, chapters 17 and 18. And we're going to, in just a few minutes, look at a pretty detailed description of this city. And again, I want you to be asking yourself as we go through that description, how would you like to live in this city? Well, the first thing we want to observe is that it really has much to commend itself. If you just look at the surface. This city is described as a woman. It's pictured as a woman throughout these two chapters. And we see that it is very much beautiful to the eye. In chapter 17, we're going to stop about midway through. We'll get to the latter part later. Chapter 17 and verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. And so this sounds like a city that is beautiful to behold, right? Now, over in chapter 18 and verse 16, you have virtually the same description, except that fine linen there is added to her adornment. And so, to the eye, we're talking about a city that is very beautiful. We can also observe that this city is very prosperous. We could even say luxurious. In chapter 18 and verse 7, again, we'll just read the first part of this. It says, in the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously. In fact, if you skip down with me to verse 12, I want you to look at some of the merchandise that can be found in this city. It says, merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon, and incense, and on it goes. Name anything valuable. Name anything profitable. And it would seem that this city has it. And so if you're looking for a place that is prospering economically, this is it. And so far we've got a city that's very beautiful to behold. It's prospering financially, economically. In fact, it's a place where you can live luxuriously. And of course, we can also notice that she made others rich too. It wasn't just that there were a few there. There were others who benefited from her great wealth. In fact, look in chapter 18 and verse 3. In the latter part of verse 3, it says, the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Verse 15, the merchants of these things who became rich by her. Verse 19, alas, the middle part of the verse, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. So many others have benefited from the prosperity of this city. And really there's something else we can notice here that will help explain why others would benefit so much from her. We're talking about a city that had great influence, very wide, vast influence on many nations. In chapter 17, verse 18, and the woman, remember that's how this city is pictured, and the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So we're talking about a city that exerts tremendous influence. Verse 15. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Now earlier in chapter 17, it just says she sits on the waters. But here it explains what it means by that. She's sitting on peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And so her influence is vast. She exerts great influence over a number of other nations. And And again, they have benefited from her vast wealth. So, if you just look on the surface, this city seems mighty attractive. Beautiful to the eye. Very prosperous, luxurious, economically. Made others rich. Yields a tremendous influence over so many other places. But then beneath the surface, it's an entirely different picture. Entirely different picture. I think you probably noticed what we were just read there in chapter 17 and verse 15. But this woman that this city is pictured as, she's described as a harlot. And not just any harlot. Look in 17 and verse 1. Let's start there. 17 and verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." Now, we said this wasn't just any harlot. Look at verse 5. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Just let that sink in for just a minute. Think about all those involved in the sin of harlotry. She's the mother of them. Name any abomination that you can think of. She's the mother of them. That's ugly, isn't it? The mother of all harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Notice what's in her hand. Now, we read just the first half of 17:4 earlier, but let's read the rest of it. We'll read the full thing this time. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. That sounds good so far, right? Having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. A golden cup full of abominations. Now, remember earlier we said that name just about anything, you know, profitable, anything valuable in terms of merchandise, and you could find it there. Well, the same goes for the abominations. Name just about any abomination, any sin you can think of, and it would seem that you could find it in this city. It's not looking quite as good now, right? That's beautiful. It's prospering financially. It has the potential to make a lot of other folks rich. It has done that. Ooh, boy. Mother of harlots. A place where you can find just about any abomination that you can think of. Remember what we said earlier about her influence, how she had helped others become rich too? Well, that influence works in this way too, right? Others obviously have been seduced by this harlot to be involved in the many abominations which she commits. And that's brought out in several passages. Look in chapter 17. After introducing this great harlot in the first verse, in verse 2 it says, "...with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Yes, let me have some. I'll take some of that." Was the attitude of many. Seduced by her harlotry. Seduced by her abominations. Look at chapter 18 and verse 13. Chapter 18 and verse 13. You remember that list of all the different things of merchandise she had in her? Let's pick up with the beginning of verse 13. There's something right at the end of verse 13 that's a little... As I explained to my high school class, you know, remember when you did patterns... You know, you'd have a list of things and you'd say, well, now which one of these doesn't belong here? See if you can find something at the end of this that doesn't belong. Cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and the bodies and souls of men. How about that? Came at a pretty heavy price, didn't it? The bodies and souls of men. To me, that just jumps right out at me. I mean, you're reading all this merchandise, and you get there, and you're thinking he's going to name some other kind of precious something, and, well, it is something precious. The bodies and souls of men. And again, none of this is surprising when you consider the God the little g god that this woman serves. Back in chapter 17 and verse 3, and I know many of you have studied Revelation here recently, and this is probably going to ring a bell when we read about this beast here. In chapter 17 and verse 3, "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Now, in the remaining verses of this chapter, there's some more detail provided about this beast, but this isn't the first time we've read about the beast, right? I believe maybe back in chapter 11 there was a little bit of information. There in chapter 13 there's quite a bit more information. In fact, let's go back to chapter 13. Just so we can know a little bit more about this beast. Chapter 13, beginning with verse 4. "So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?' And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven." That's what worship is in this city. That's what it's centered on. That's who they're worshiping, and this is what he's demanding. And this is the character of this person that they're worshiping. He's blaspheming against God. It's an utter rejection of the one true God. Are you still asking the question? Still asking the question, how would you like to live in the city? Now, you could be doing pretty well in some respects. Boy, it's a lot to be surrounded by, wouldn't you say? Well, what about those who resisted her influence? Those who refused to commit fornication with her? Those who refused to participate in her abomination? Those who refused to worship the beast, what about them? Now, I hope you're of a mind that if you did live in this city, that you would be counted among those who did refuse these things, right? Wouldn't you? Surely we would all not want to participate in these things. What about these people? How does the city treat folks like this? Well, look in chapter 17 and verse 6. Revelation 17 and verse 6. "I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement." Chapter 18 and verse 24. We found a lot of things in this city, haven't we? Gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, but look what else is found. 18:24. "And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints, and of all who were slain on the earth." And that really kind of takes us back to something that we read earlier about the beast and about those who refused to worship the beast. Look back in chapter 13 and verse 15. Revelation 13 and verse 15. "He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed." And sure enough, we find this woman drunk with the blood of the saints. This would be a really good time to ask the question again. How would you like to live in this city? And the reason why this is such a good time to ask that question is there's a good chance you wouldn't even live. Not for very long. Not if you refuse to participate in these abominations. Not if you refuse to worship the beast. Not if you refuse to commit fornication, spiritual fornication with her. Well, what we want to also understand about this woman, as bad as she is, she's too arrogant to realize just how ugly she is. She's too arrogant to realize that the God whom she has rejected will bring her into account. Look in chapter 18. In chapter 18, beginning with verse 5, "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." You can't carry on like this and God not notice. He knows exactly what's going on. "Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix double for her. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, 'I sit as queen, and am no widow, and will not see sorrow.'" You see the arrogance? "Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her." And what I'd like to do here is read some other part of chapter 15 here, because really what the rest of this chapter is devoted to is the fall of this city. This city that looked so attractive, this city that thought of itself as being unconquerable, that nothing could ever happen to it, it's going down. And it's going down in a big way. Now, as you continue reading there in verse 9, you read about how the people who had been made wealthy by her, they're weeping and they're wailing. I mean, here's their sugar daddy, so to speak. And their sugar daddy's being brought down. But let's start with verse 15 and just read through the end of the chapter. These details are too good to miss. 18:15. "The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in one hour, such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ships, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What is like this great city?'" Kind of reminds you of some of the questions asked about the beast earlier, right? Who is like the great beast? Now the same sort of question is being asked about the city, right? But it's in a little bit different context this time, right? A little bit different context. "They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. For in one hour she is made desolate. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her.' Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore.' The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore, and the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you any more, and the voice of bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you any more. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived. And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints, and of all who were slain on the earth." If you've been through the book of Revelation before, you know one of the key passages is back in chapter 6. You have pictured there the souls under the altar, and you remember what they're crying out? How long, O Lord, until you avenge our blood? And the answer given to them is, you're going to have to rest a little while until it's done. It's not going to be done right away. But now you see that cry being answered. You see their blood being avenged on this city. Now you notice this city is called Babylon here. Not the literal city of Babylon. It's called Babylon. You know what else it's called? Back in chapter 11. It's called Egypt. It's also called by another name, Sodom. You know, if you're familiar with biblical history, none of those names evoke very good memories. The children of God spent 70 years in Babylonian captivity. When Babylon came in, although they were executing God's wrath against His people, they were unusually cruel to God's people when they came in and destroyed the city of Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. In fact, later when punishment is announced against Babylon, their cruelty, their utter cruelty is pointed out. They know what Babylon is all about. Egypt, they spent 400 years in slavery in Egypt. They also know about how bad that was. And Sodom, Sodom stands forever as a picture of the worst kind of immorality you can possibly think of. That's what this city is. It's Babylon. It's Sodom. It's Egypt. And everything about those particular cities. Well, what we want to understand is that first century Christians lived in this culture. How about that? First century Christians lived in this culture. Didn't have a chance, right? Didn't have a chance, surely. As bad as things were. Well, let's first of all notice that this really explains the admonition given in chapter 18 and verse 4. In chapter 18 and verse 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people. Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. Now, I don't dismiss the fact that for some this might actually involve picking up stakes and going somewhere else, but I don't think that's really the bottom line point here. And I think when we look at another passage later, we'll see that. Come out of her. In other words, have nothing to do with her. Do not participate in anything like what you have heard about the city. Do not participate in any of these abominations. Do not touch what is unclean. Is the way 2 Corinthians 6 says it. That's the admonition here. You're surrounded by it, but you don't have to participate in it. You're surrounded by it, but you don't have to approve of it. You can still follow the Lamb rather than follow the beast. You can still be married to Him instead of to this harlot right here. You can still do it. And really, that kind of also helps explain the promises at the end of each of the seven letters. You remember how each of those seven letters end? The expression is either to him who overcomes or he who overcomes. To him who overcomes, this will be given. Or he who overcomes shall be whatever. There's a promise made. Now, read carefully those letters. Now, we all know that persecution was a big issue with which they were confronted. But hopefully we've heard enough about this city to know there was another issue that they were confronted with, and that's the immorality that they were surrounded by. Read those letters. Do you think they had already been affected? Do you think there were Christians who were already being affected by that? Do you think that that immorality had seeped into these local churches? You better believe it. And so that's why it's important that they understand, okay, this is what we're up against. Maybe this is what we have already let come in. But if we overcome, here are the wonderful promises that we could have. What a contrast to this city is the city pictured in chapters 21 and 22. We won't go through and make all of the comparisons in the lesson today. That hopefully will be for another time. But I do want to point out something to you. I want you to look with me. Chapter 17 and verse 1. Look at the last part of chapter 17 and verse 1. I want to put these two right up against each other. 17:1. Second half. Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Alright, now look at 21:9. 21:9. Look at the last sentence in 21:9. Come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. Which one of them you think wins that beauty contest? The harlot or the bride, the Lamb's wife? You remember all that weeping and wailing that we read about there in chapter 18? None of that in heaven, right? None of that in the holy city. This is not a harlot. In fact, in the first part of chapter 21, she's pictured as a bride adorned for her husband. Remember how we said you name just about any abomination and you can find it in this city described in chapter 17 and 18? How many abominations are in this city? How many? Zero. Nothing that defiles, not a single abomination shall enter this city. Can you imagine how wonderful that would be? Because really all of the suffering in this world ultimately goes back to the entrance of sin into the world. And so everything will be perfect about this place. That's what we've got to look forward to. And imagine as they're reading this letter, the original recipients of this. And they read chapter 17 and 18 and they say, yep. That's what we see around us. And we don't like it one bit. And then he gets to chapters 21 and 22 and he shows them a picture of something that's just the complete opposite of it in every way. It's like, wow, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice? And it will be. It will be. All the joy is taken out of that city in chapter 17 and 18. There's nothing but joy here. I would encourage you just to go through and just make point by point contrast to these cities. Well, I think it would be a mistake for us to just stay in the first century. Did any of y'all live in the first century? Did any of y'all in the past live in the first century? Of course not. We live today, and so let's just think about today. You notice I haven't spend any time trying to tell you, okay, well, the beast represents this entity and the city represents... I'm not even particularly worried about that tonight. Okay? That was the culture that they lived in. What about today? When the New Testament talks about the world, and I understand that world is sometimes used in different senses, but when the New Testament talks about the world, that is, you know, that which is the evil part, that which contains all the wickedness in the world... It's really pretty much the same thing, right? It's pretty much the same picture. Turn with me to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John 2, beginning with verse 15. 1 John 2, beginning with verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. How many sins do you think we could put in the category of lust of the flesh? We could put a whole bunch, right? And then we move on to the lust of the eyes. How many could we put there? And then we move on to the pride of life. These are pretty comprehensive categories, right? I would suppose that just about any sin you could name would fall under one of these three categories. That's what's in the world. That's That's what's in the world. I don't know how to make an exact comparison to what we just read there in chapter 17 and 18 in our situation in Prattville, Alabama, or Maplesville, or wherever we may live, but there's enough out there that we pretty much are surrounded by it, right? Well, you remember the admonition we read earlier, chapter 18, verse 4, come out of her, do not share in her sins. Look with me in 2 Corinthians 6. I think I briefly mentioned this passage earlier. 2 Corinthians 6. 2 Corinthians 6, beginning with verse 16. And it would be helpful to even read before this, but we would start. Let's start in verse 16. In what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them. See it there? Come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you. And you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. Now, here's one of those places where the chapter break is most unfortunate. Let's make sure we bring in verse 1 of chapter 7. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Well, there's encouragement, of course, right here to do exactly that, to keep ourselves clean from all the pollutions around us. But I want us to think about some other things we've learned in the lesson that will kind of motivate us to that end. We need to remember what's under the surface. We need to remember what's under the surface. There's no question that there's an allurement out there to the world. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. I mean, it's just dangling all these things out in front of us and it just looks like candy to us. It looks wonderful, doesn't it? Thank you very much. I'll have some of that. But we forget what's under the surface. We forget just how ugly it is. How many people have found that out, right? I would think the prodigal son pretty much illustrates that. I don't think he had any of that pictured. When he said, hey, Dad, can I have my half of the inheritance? I'm going to go out here and have a good... I don't think he pictured any of that. It gets ugly, and it gets ugly fast. There's a downward spiral to these sort of things, right? Once we can talk ourselves into doing this, and maybe a little bit of that, then we can do a little bit more of this, and a little bit more of that. And now all of a sudden, we're just in the depths of degradation. That's just kind of the way it works, right? Let's remember what's under the surface. And we need to remember those promises. Go back and read. It would be helpful for any of us, or all of us, to go back. Read all those promises in chapters 2 and 3. You don't have to look hard. They're right at the end of each one of those letters. To him who overcomes, I will give this. Well, here's a little hint. Here's a way to kind of sum up all of those. All of them are real nice. They're all real, real nice. They're all things that we'd want to have, and we don't want to miss out on any of them. So we're going to overcome. We're going to overcome. We're not going to be seduced by all of these things. We need to look especially, though, at that promise of the eternal home. Contrast the two cities. If when you contrast the two cities, if you come to the conclusion after that, oh, I think I'll take the one in 17 and 18, you have lost your mind. You really have. We know which one's better. We know which one's better. Bottom line is we can overcome. In fact, many of these first century Christians did exactly that. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 11. It would sure be a... There's no telling how many important passages I've left out, but I know it would be bad to leave this one out. Revelation 12 and verse 11. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives to the death. One of the beautiful things about the book of Revelation is it gives us a picture of what an overcomer looks like. It gives us a picture of what an overcomer looks like. And that's exactly what we want to be. And this kind of breaks it down for us. Obviously, they had to depend on the blood of the Lamb. You know, back in chapter 7, you remember there was the throne scene where you had them with their white robes on. Well, the only way our robes can be white, and the only way we can keep them that way, is by the blood of the Lamb. By the word of their testimony, they continued to preach and to practice those things which were right. And they loved the Lord more than they did their own life. In fact, over in chapter 14 and verse 4, you've got another throne scene pictured there. And this will kind of stand in contrast to what we just read in chapter 17 and 18 earlier. Notice how these faithful are described. Chapter 14 and verse 4. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. I think we know enough here to know we're not talking about people who've never had physical contact with the opposite sex. We're talking about in a spiritual sense. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever He goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Anna Grace was baptized this morning. And I don't know that I said it exactly like this, but one of the things that I encouraged her with before she was baptized is to do exactly this. I said, you have made a commitment to follow the Lord. I said, so hold on to Him all through your life. Can we follow the Lamb wherever He goes? Absolutely. Sure, there will be times when we'll go astray and we'll need to come back. We'll need to wash our robes again in the blood of the Lamb. But we're still going to hold fast to it. We're not going to forsake it. Now, if we follow the Lamb wherever He goes, where do we wind up? If we follow the Lamb wherever He goes, where do we wind up? We wind up where He is, in that holy city, in that heavenly home. And that's where we ultimately want to be. So, how would you like to live in that city? Well, in some ways we do even today. In some ways, at least. But we can't overcome. And we can receive every single one of those promises that God has made for us. Get your song books out. We'll sing the song of invitation here in just a moment. Isn't Revelation a great book? I wish I understood it even better. I think in the years to come, as I continue to study it and meditate on it and figure things out even more, I think it will become even more powerful. But, boy, some great pictures that are painted there for us. If we can help anyone tonight becoming a Christian, being buried with Christ in baptism, being raised to walk in a new life, or if we can help you come back to the Lord, maybe you have been seduced by the world and involved in some things, and you say, well, you know what, I need to come back to Him. I haven't been following the Lamb wherever He goes. We can help you in any way that you might let us know tonight.